The president's plan to find a cure for cancer will depend an awful lot on big data. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, sitting in for Kai Rizdahl. We're happy you could join us today. It's Wednesday, January 13th, and it is a marvelous day for a moonshot. President Obama's final State of the Union address is in the book, and although it was light on specific policy promises, there was one. The president said he's putting Vice President Joe Biden in charge of a moonshot to help find a cure for cancer. Biden's gotten some of the credit for sending $264 million in research funding to the National Institutes of Health. Now, cancer experts hope Biden can help unlock patient data that could help researchers tremendously, but which right now is almost impossible to share. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
Statistics from the American Cancer Society predict 600,000 people will die from the disease this year, and 1.6 million men and women will be diagnosed. Behind each of those cases is data.
And that data is all exists now in electronic medical records, and that largely, for mostly proprietary reasons, don't communicate well with each other.
Dr. Richard Shilsky is the chief medical officer for the American Society of Clinical Oncology. Shilsky says there's broad agreement the nation could speed up the development of new cancer treatments if researchers could get their hands on larger data sets. Julia Adler-Milstein from the University of Michigan would like to think this new initiative will grease the collaboration gears, but she's skeptical.
These big priorities then have to get trickled down through organizations who have to make decisions about where to spend their time and money.
Adler-Milstein says momentum could come from new regulations and tough talk from federal health officials. It could also come from tech heavyweights like Google and IBM jumping into the game. This week, Vice President Biden said the goal is to seize this moment. IBM's Deborah DiZanzo says to get there, those who profit from holding data must make sacrifices.
It is a hard problem. There's many, many different cancers, many, many different treatments for those cancers. And so we also have to have a bit of patience with us.
Patience and a mix of carrots and sticks to make business sense for organizations who today make money off of data. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
The president also talked a lot about how strong the economy is, but according to our Economic Anxiety Index, that's not how the public is seeing things. Check out what we found at Marketplace.org. The major U.S. airlines, Delta, American, United, and even the big discount carriers like Alaska and Southwest, all had banner years in 2015. After years of struggle during the recession and its aftermath, they are making profits hand over fist. So is that good news for the flying public? Well, sort of. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
It's been a very good year for U.S. airlines, the ones that are left after a decade of bankruptcies and mega mergers, says Jim Corridor at S&P Capital IQ.
There is a lot less competition now than there ever has been in the sector.
Plummeting oil prices have helped. Jet fuel is one of the biggest operating costs airlines have. And what are they doing with their newfound profits?
They are rewarding shareholders, buying back stock, paying dividends.
But Corridor says the flying public benefits too.
Airlines are investing in their product, modernizing fleet to get more fuel efficiency. They are updating airport facilities.
Also investing in new technology to track bags better, board planes more efficiently, says Seth Kaplan at Airline Weekly.
Punctuality, you know, not losing bags. By those measures, a lot of these airlines are actually doing very well.
The Department of Transportation says major airlines just turned in one of their best on-time arrival records in 20 years. Though it sure doesn't feel like service is improving to many flyers, like Hazel Schlesinger in Portland, Oregon.
Less inches per seat being dinged every time you bring an item on. There's a lot of customer service that's gone by the wayside.
Consumer psychologists say people feel this way because of the hassles of flying nowadays. Tight security and long lines, lugging around those heavy carry-ons to avoid checked bag fees. And yet, says Schlesinger,
but I still fly. I love where I get to.
In her case, an upcoming vacation to the South Pacific. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a bunch of companies are hoping they win the Powerball. Big drops all around. We will have the very sad music details when we do the numbers. Just about a month ago now in Paris, world leaders struck an unprecedented deal that they hope will limit climate change. Whatever the outcome of that deal, part of the sense of urgency comes from fears about the effect of climate change on global food production. And with that and other catastrophes in mind, researchers have gathered a unique collection of seeds from many of the most important plants, like rice, wheat, and maize. And they're storing them in a special doomsday vault carved into a mountain on the Arctic island of Svalbard. The BBC's David Shookman was given special access.
There's been quite a fall of snow this afternoon here on Svalbard, the Arctic islands that lie to the north of Norway. I'm approaching a strange concrete structure rising from the hillside here. This is what's called the Global Seed Vault. And that roaring sound you can hear, that's the cooling system keeping the place at a chilly minus 18. Okay, so we've got the next stage of this journey coming up. There we go, that sounds like the door's open.
Yeah.
So with me is Simon Jepson, who's carrying the latest delivery. And, well, we've now entered a tunnel that seems to be lined in steel panels. We're descending for, what, 100 metres or so?
Yeah, that's correct.
Looks like we're really getting inside the mountain right now.
Yeah, this is the solid rock. It's sand rock, and here you experience the permafrost.
That's always below zero.
Yeah, correct.
I'm now stepping into the heart of the vault, what they call the cathedral. You can probably hear the echo of this great cavern. This place is designed to withstand everything from a missile attack to the very worst that global warming could produce with a total melting of the ice caps. And ahead of me is a door that's very heavily frosted. You can probably hear that. This leads to the actual store of the various seeds. Now I'm about to take a look. Okay, here we go. I'm now inside the inner sanctum of the seed vault. Row upon row of plastic boxes holding more than 800,000 little packets of seeds from more than 5,000 different species of plant. Already some of the seeds from Syria, known to be very resilient to drought, have been withdrawn from the vault and sent back to the Middle East where they'll be put to use. A powerful motivation for this project is to maintain as many different types of plants as possible, above all to preserve genetic variety, according to one of the people in charge, Roland von Bertner.
A big effort here. What's all this for?
It is for the survival of mankind in the future. I mean, we need the diversity, all the different kinds of plant material to get foods for the future. We have a lot of problems seeing us now. Climate change, environmental problems, and to tackle that, we need genetic variation.
Is there a risk that so much of our food comes from so few plants?
That's actually what it is. For three species, maize, rice, and wheat, 60% of the world calories come from these. And if a disease hits one of those, then we are in serious problems.
People would say this is quite gloomy, that you're forecasting global apocalypse.
No, on the contrary. We are looking at the safe side and we know that we need this genetic variation we do have. That's a security for the future.
It's not a prophecy of doom.
No, not at all. Not at all for me at all. It's a daily problem that we can see as things happen in the world and we take precautions for that.
So this extraordinary place, buried out of the wind inside an Arctic mountain, is an insurance policy in a troubled and warming world.
That's the BBC's David Shookman. Now from doomsday to payday, there's a big FCC auction coming up for TV station licenses, but this one has a twist. Instead of TV stations bidding for more airspace, they're bidding for the FCC to pay them to go off air. Why would they do that? Because the FCC wants that space on the airwaves to stream video to your phone, in essence. One surprising potential winner in all this auction frenzy, billionaire Michael Dell. Since 2011, his company has been quietly buying up TV stations around the country, which now looks like a pretty savvy investment. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more.
American airwaves are getting pretty crowded. Increasing use of mobile devices means we're running out of bandwidth to go around. Howard Simons is vice chair of the FCC's Incentive Auction Task Force.
The demand for wireless spectrum is immense and continually growing. That's why Congress told us essentially to realign the use of the TV band to better meet today's consumer demand between TV and wireless.
Congress told the FCC to pay traditional TV stations to go off air, making more room for wireless. Suddenly, teeny tiny stations playing Catholic Mass or Roseanne reruns were potentially worth millions. Blair Levin is with the Brookings Institution.
There were several groups that made a very conscious effort to buy a number of broadcast stations that would be particularly valuable in this auction and are now intending to resell them.
Michael Dell's investment firm owns one of those groups and now stands to make billions. Other companies gobbled up stations too, taking a pretty significant risk at the time. Robin Flynn is a senior analyst with media research firm SNL Kagan.
In many cases, they bought these stations very early on before we really were certain the auction was going forward.
Most of the stations selling bandwidth aren't necessarily canceling their programming. Flynn says they're working out deals to do things like share channels so they can stay in business. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up,
LA was literally built as a drain.
Well, that explains a lot. But first, let's do the numbers. Numbers were really not good. The Dow Jones Industrial Average declined 364 points, 2.2% to close at 16,151. The NASDAQ lost 159 points, 3.4% to finish at 4526. And the S&P 500 subtracted 48 points, 2.5% to end at 1890. We told you earlier about those healthy profits for airlines last year, but for today, those companies faced headwinds. United Continental descended 5.5%, Delta gave back 4.3%, American declined 4.5%. GoPro announced it would cut 7% of its workforce. The wearable camera maker fell nearly 28% in after-hours trading. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell 2.07%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
You're listening to Marketplace from APM. I'm Molly Wood. In the wake of terror attacks in Paris and San Bernardino, global discussion about encryption became an ongoing debate. Protect user privacy and allow strong encryption technology for messages, or prioritize national security by allowing the government backdoors into encryption. Now, the White House is poised to issue a policy on encryption. Marketplace Tech has been covering the debate. Host Ben Johnson joins me now to bring us up to speed. Hi, Ben. How are you?
I'm well. How are you, Molly?
I am great, and I am hopeful, or maybe I'm not. Is it real that we may finally have some sort of national policy on encryption and backdoors pretty soon?
I got your good news and I got your bad news. The bad news, Molly, is no, policy isn't likely to be finalized this week. You may have noticed that in the president's State of the Union speech, it was not really highlighted. And though White House officials and tech bigwigs apparently met last week in San Jose, no big announcements coming out of that. The good news, Molly, is perhaps for those who do want movement here, is that members of the Intelligence Committee in Congress are reportedly working this week on a bill that would create a national commission on security and technology. This commission would include privacy advocates, law enforcement, tech executives, and more. The piece of legislation, interestingly, would not require companies to build backdoors for law enforcement access to data.
That is interesting because we know that law enforcement, at least some corners of law enforcement, have been asking for this so-called backdoor. They're probably going to keep pushing, though, right? No matter what this legislation says?
I think they will. The Washington Post reported that FBI Director James Comey actually refused to attend last week's meeting between tech heads and others in San Jose unless backdoors were on the table. On the one hand, you're going to continue to have some in government pushing tech companies and others to provide easy access to data that has been encrypted or scrambled. On the other hand, you might remember that President Bill Clinton tried to do something similar to this back in the 1990s to force tech companies to build special access to encrypted data, and then backed off, Molly, when civil liberties advocates and technologists said this would be really, really bad policy. So you've sort of seen the White House do something similar here, soften its language around breaking encryption or building backdoors.
And in fact, there are some reports, they're anecdotal, but that Tim Cook came out of that meeting and said that the White House was being, quote, wishy-washy
yeah,
on the question.
He wanted more leadership, so it, right? Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So it sounds like even if we see some legislation, even if we see a policy, it does not seem likely that anybody's willing to provide that leadership or that we're going to see this debate go anywhere. Is that fair to say?
Not yet. Yeah, I think that's fair to say, Molly. And also another thing that's important to remember, if you've ever purchased something online, if you've ever checked your bank account balance online, if you've done any number of things that are part of this vast economic engine that is the internet, you have used encryption. And there are other potentially really important uses as well, Molly. And that's why a lot of this encryption exists. I spoke with the new executive director of the Onion Router, or Tor, project, which builds encryption tools for communicating and browsing online. Her name is Sherry Steele, and she had this to say about encryption.
It's being used by just regular old people who are interested in doing searches on the internet that are private and that people can't see that they're trying to learn more information about HIV or abortion or about anything that might be a controversial topic or even not necessarily controversial.
So I think that a lot of advocates, Molly, will keep wanting strong encryption, and so the debate likely won't go away soon. But a national commission might help to figure out at least perhaps some third way that hasn't been discovered yet. We shall see.
All right, we'll keep an eye out for the third way. Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech, thanks so much.
Thank you, Molly.
El Nino has finally arrived in Southern California. The drought-starved region got heavy rains for the first time in a long time last week, and more is coming. But here's the thing. Nearly all of that stormwater ends up in the Pacific Ocean. After 4 years of drought, that may strike you as a colossal waste. But as Sarah Gardner reports from our sustainability desk, the people who built this sprawling West Coast metropolis wanted it that way.
In Los Angeles, this winter's El Nino could turn out to be a replay of 1998, when the city got drenched with almost a year's worth of rain in a single month. Mudslides, sewage spills, $500 million in damage, and 17 fatalities. But for all the damage El Nino could inflict on the city today, there's little chance of a replay of this.
Disaster, destruction, and death descend on five Southern California counties. Tons of water submerged 30,000 square miles of populous beach and valley towns in the Los Angeles area, leaving 200 persons dead or missing.
That was 1938, one in a series of deadly floods in the early 20th century that shaped the city's future relationship with rainwater and its fundamental design.
LA was literally built as a drain.
Andy Lipkus, founder of the environmental group Tree People, says Los Angeles was designed to keep humans and water apart. Even in unexceptional years, winter rains here are like, well, a bad boyfriend. Intemperate, unreliable, and when they do come around, they leave a big old mess. So the city shoes out rainwater as fast as it can.
It flows off our property so quickly that we don't see it. It's gone.
Down rain gutters, into sloped driveways to storm drains that pour into local rivers and straight out to the Pacific Ocean. Right now, Los Angeles captures just 8% of all the water that falls or flows into the city. The rest is channeled into the ocean via paved creeks and rivers, like the now tamed Los Angeles River.
The Army Corps of Engineers did it, and it was a massive project.
Poet and activist Lewis McAdams, founder of Friends of the Los Angeles River. He's standing on the river's banks just north of downtown. This part of the river has a natural bottom because the water table is so high. But for most of its 51 miles, from the San Fernando Valley to Long Beach, it's encased in concrete.
There were 17,000 people paving the river by hand at the end of the Depression. 3 million barrels of concrete were poured. The Corps of Engineers put out a little book after they were so proud of this paving, and the word ecology was never mentioned, or the idea that in a Mediterranean climate that it might be valuable to hold on to that water.
The feds straightened, widened, and deepened the river so it wouldn't overflow its banks and threaten homes and businesses in its unpredictable path. This vast network of dams, concrete channels, catch basins, and over 2,000 miles of storm drain pipe fixed LA's worst flood problems. But residents were now physically and psychologically separated from the city's main waterway. Environmental historian Robert Gottlieb.
The river became totally off limits. You know, there was actual barbed wire in places. There were the sense that you keep away. This is a place of danger.
Hollywood reinforced that scary image. Remember the chase scene in Terminator 2? And perhaps more bizarrely,
a science fiction film in the 50s called Them, where you had giant irradiated ants crawling out of the storm drains to wreak havoc on Los Angeles.
Is there any type of gas we could use?
No, we can't take a chance. It might poison the whole city.
Few residents ventured to see the river. In the dry months, it's a mere trickle anyway, the banks marred by graffiti and garbage. Even homes built near the river usually faced away from it. So the storm water that flowed through it in the winter, out of sight, out of mind, and relatively devalued. But that's beginning to change.
Well, right now we're looking at about 40 acres of what was an inert landfill. So
Kurjan Lee with Los Angeles County Public Works guides me to the top of a 30-foot dirt berm in the San Fernando Valley. This was once a graveyard for concrete and other construction waste. Now, backhoes are clearing out debris, making way for rainwater capture on a large scale, a wetlands park with ponds and swales that collect and filter rainwater.
When it rains now, that water is largely lost to the LA River. What we're designing these projects to do and what the hope is that that water will be collected here and then returned to the groundwater system and eventually go to the public's tap.
This park is part of a long-term strategy between the city and the county to make the region less dependent on water imported from Northern California. Mike Antos directs the Center for Urban Water Resilience at Cal State Northridge.
The reliance on imported water that the city of LA has long benefited from, we're starting to understand that those are unsustainable. So there isn't much longer that people are going to be immune to the increasing costs of acquiring water from very far away.
True, but city water officials say capturing more rainwater will cost more. Under a 20-year master plan, the city at least doubles its capture rate. But even the plan's conservative scenario would cost more than $40 million a year, and funding's uncertain. Rainwater capture isn't cheap, even in your own backyard.
This is the tank, and I think plastic.
North Hollywood resident Carrie Wassenaar shows off her 1,300-gallon rainwater barrel to a gaggle of reporters. She's part of a pilot project focusing on high-tech rain barrels.
It's a smart system, so it monitors how much water is in it and what the weather is going to be. If it's going to rain, it decides whether or not it needs to drain. And if they drain it into the rain garden in the front.
Which eventually seeps into the aquifer under the city. But these computerized systems are expensive, $25,000 for one house. So government subsidies are a must, says Andy Lipkus. It may take time for the price to come down, a la solar panels, he says. But real change takes time. Consider this. In one western state, Colorado, it's still illegal to collect rainwater from your own roof. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
We have lots of archival photos of the LA River, plus a montage of its many movie appearances, all at marketplace.org. And while you're there, check out our brand new website. It's now in beta. This final note before we go, if this evening's billion-dollar Powerball draw is anything, it's a jackpot for data journalists. The number of words written about the Powerball is now approaching the number of dollars in the pot. To be fair, it's mostly good reading. There are a lot of pieces about things that are more likely to happen than winning, such as becoming the president of the United States. The LA Times has a clever interactive simulator that pits your $100 against randomly generated numbers. Spoiler, you always lose. But my favorite award goes to The Atlantic, which calculated how much it would cost if you bought every ticket combination. It turns out it's less than the total jackpot. You could buy every mathematical combination for $584,402,676. And they say that before taxes, you could make a roughly $439 million profit. Then there's a lot more math about the split jackpots and things, but there's just a little time left before the drawing. So let's stop with the math and get back to the fantasizing. Good luck, everyone. And that is our show. Today, the Dow declined 364 points, 2.2%. The NASDAQ lost 159 points, 3.4%. And the S&P 500 subtracted 48 points. That was 2.5%. Chris Clark, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer this program for us. I am Molly Wood. We'll be right back here again tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.